Now, of course, what worked out very feasibly and very easily when I started, the place has gotten, the journal has gotten, you've seen copies of and have you, and you've, it's not entirely, shall we say, it's a rather large operation. We have a lot of papers. We had 28,000 pages last year. We have over 7,000 manuscripts a year. What happens is, again, I shouldn't really be talking personally, it's the overall implications that are important, but the way it works is that the papers come in, I speak to the office once a day, usually at lunch or after lunch, depending on whether I have seminar or not, and try to assign the papers to an associate editor. I can do that from the title in about 3/4. The other quarter they send me at night. Our system is set up, well, I'll come back to that. They send me a bag. Fortunately, I'm very close to the office, and by being at the NIH, they deliver a bag to me in the evening with the work that I need to sign and things like that, and they pick it up for me in the morning. Now, obviously, that keeps my evenings quite busy. Computers have helped an enormous amount because I do all my typing on the computer and I send it over by modem in the morning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's been extremely useful from a technical point of view because it saves time. In many cases, they can then even assign my name and send it off because it comes over exactly like I wrote it. There's no worry about spelling and that kind of thing. And we can come back to some of the technical aspects later. Now, let me just mention the principle on which the journal operates. Well, one is beginning when John Edsel, well, no. It's always run by the Publications Committee, which is an elected committee of the society. And they have the primary responsibility for the journal. And there was a big change in the operation of the journal around 1958. Then John Edsel took over. As you know, the journal started about 1905 or thereabouts. And it's grown steadily since then. I've forgotten the doubling times, probably every 10 years, 8 to 10 years. Like compound interest, though, that gets to be rather large. We're set up, for historic and other reasons, where we have a number of associate editors. There were 3 or 4 when I started, now we have about 17. We send the papers to one of those associate editors, in a special field. They, in turn, send it out to one or more, usually one to start with, editorial board member. The editorial board is appointed by the Publications Committee from a slate that we nominate, indicating who's leaving, what subjects we need, and so forth. As opposed to most journals, our principle is that the editorial board member is an editor, not a referee, per se. He can act as a referee, too. But we want that editorial board member to think of the overall contribution and to even write a draft decision letter. Are you sure you're...
Yeah, come on.
And he is closer to the field than the associate editor. So he, in turn, if he needs help, and depending on how confident he is, can send it out to referees who send back a referee report to him, you see. Now, if a paper is accepted, that's probably it, usually. If it's declined, but for, or just sent back for revision, the associate editor looks to see if it's been reviewed adequately, and especially if there are other referees, and sends it back to the author. If it's declined, then either the associate editor reads it himself and writes a decision letter, or he sends it to somebody, another editor. So it's a very decentralized operation, you see. We try very hard now to expedite things at every step. So, for example, for the last year, 2 years, we're sending all our opinions out by fax. We use express mail to the associate editors. And our... can I get you some tea or anything else? And I try personally to take a fair number of the manuscripts. Up until recently, I really took as much, if not more, than each associate editor, because again, I wanted to have the feeling for it. However, with the increasing size in the last few years, this year I'm taking perhaps a little less than the other associate editors, because there are enough other things that come up, as you can imagine, in the operation, among policy matters and otherwise, that is probably a little wiser, because that takes up a little more time. You've probably noticed we have a mini review section where we, with the help of the associate editors or their advice, choose people to write 4-page articles in reviewing a field. Then once a year we collect those in a compendium that's distributed free to all members of the society. Have you probably haven't seen that?
No.
Let me see if I have it on the top and show it to you. And this is very useful for teaching purposes. Since it's reprinted, we can sell it very inexpensively. So if people buy, say, 25, I think it's something that runs between $4 and $6 a copy. So it's very useful for teaching purposes. We also have recently shifted. We've also have an edition, a CD-ROM. Edition with infinite retrieval capability. So all the articles are on CD-ROM, and you can select any word in the article, and it will immediately list all the articles that have that word. So you could, shall we say, list spermine, let's say, and you'll find all the articles with spermine, and it includes the figures, and is sort of an exciting development.
This is a very very important kind of
this mini review
concept. Yes,
yeah,
yes,
and I find it personally. And I think it answers a lot of the things you've been asking, very exciting in the sense that people have said, how can you fill up, week after week and get a collection like this? And I say, it's no problem at all. Science is moving so fast that the list in every field is enormous, mm-hmm. of good, solid developments and good people, and even more things that we published several years ago, that same field has developed so far that we can do another one. So of course, getting people to write and getting it to write within 4 pages and to have it easily with good clarity, that's something else again. But it's quite a challenge. But that's been sort of a really a lot of fun. It also indicates, I think, to the readership and the kinds of things we're interested in, and so forth. So
I'm just looking to see when it started. Looks like 88.
Yeah, it's not too many years. Yeah, and but I think one of the more these trivial technical things become of some importance. For example, since we want it to be inexpensive, we're not advertising, you see. So, the compendium. Well, first place, you might argue, just having the compendium, and this was, if I recall, probably almost completely my idea, in the sense that, which of course I discussed with other people first, but it occurred to me that you have these people, these very good people, writing these excellent reviews. Actually, Arthur Kornberg wrote the first, and they got a lot of reprint requests, enormous requests. But individual articles are sort of lost eventually, mm-hmm. in the big journal, and that once people have written it, why not put them together and have a better distribution? And then I had the idea of that since we don't want to spend money on extensive advertising, and even that you're not sure how effective it is, that that once these articles have been done, that we can send it to our membership without charge, and markedly increase the people who see it. And of course, that works both ways, because it's a lot easier for me to get people to write the articles if they know they're going to have mm-hmm. such a good audience. And then, of course, we hope that we get it for students and abroad. And I think it's had a good reception. And as I say, that and the CD-ROM are the new things. But the main challenge is to get, coming back to the basic journal, is to have a good editorial board, good associate editors, and we've been very fortunate in all that, and to have good reviews. And of course, reviewing is always a difficult thing, because as you want to do the right thing, and we do have the principle that we always permit reconsideration of a declined manuscript if an author feels that it isn't correct, or he can rebut it. And I really have a personal feeling that the other associates agree with, at least to a large extent, that we won't be dogmatic about any decision, that why argue a decision, that the fairest thing is to get another review. And if somebody else feels the same way, well, he might be wrong too, but at least that's much fairer than being stuffy about it. So at least we've tried that way. Now, you might argue, to a certain extent, we've been too successful, and we're still increasing the number of manuscripts received at 10% a year, and 8 to 10%. And the next year we may have to go to, undoubtedly we'll have to go to a weekly. We're trying to cut back a bit, and it brings up a very difficult question of how many pages can we publish, or should, and more important, how many pages can the people absorb? And this is, of course, why we think the CD-ROM is a good thing, because it permits you to retrieve. But again, I think it's a function of success of the science establishment and the success of all the grants and everything else. And it's sort of exciting to see it develop, but it is as someone I think calculated, I think if we published every day, it'd be 65 pages, which is rather incredible. Well, I don't know what more you I have a feeling I should talk for hours on that, but on this, but I don't know, quite know what you,
well,
if you could stimulate me on my questions.
All right, let's go back to some early history.
By the way, you probably want to go home before you get,
well,
you still have time.
It's up to you. I mean, I can always come back to do some more. That's not a problem, but if you don't mind going for a little bit longer.
No, if you don't mind, yeah.
That'll be fine.
What I would think would be good, but this is up to you, depending on how it looks when you see it, that it might be it might be worthwhile to talk some more after
we have the transcript.
After you have it and after you or I have more comments on it, instead of just changing it by hand, which you could do, it might be a little more free association,
sure.
But I'll leave that up to you.
All right. Well,
but I'd much rather, if you have the time, to finish the to at least go over the journal stuff,
sure.
Because that I think is most important. I mean,
well, then let me go back to 1961. My indication is that you were at least on the editorial board beginning in 1961.
Yeah, I don't remember when, but I had a period on the editorial board under John Edsel.
Okay.
And I, by the way, I should use this opportunity to say what's perfectly obvious, that John Edsel was terribly influential in the way the journal is nowadays, in the atmosphere, in the fairness, and the lack of dogmatism. Everybody was... And the confidence people had in the journal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's terribly important. I might, perhaps should say, but I don't really know this, so I shouldn't say too much, but there was a certain criticism of the journal before, perhaps unfounded, perhaps founded, that it tended, when it was the only journal in the country in biochemistry, before biochemistry started, before archives started, at times being a little arbitrary. But of course, whether that's justified or not, I wouldn't know. There was a small, because biochemistry was small, the editorial board was small. And anyway, John Edsel was very important in creating the atmosphere that this was a society journal for the good of, unequivocally for the good of everybody, and I think it had made a terribly important contribution in this regard.
I was going to ask, since you said Edsel was the person who selected you for the editorial board, what do you look for in a person,
yeah,
as an associate editor, for example?
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. Dr. Edsel was involved when I was on the editorial board, not as associate editor.
Okay.
Yeah. And technically speaking, and it was even more so at that period, the publications committee makes the appointment, but they do it with his advice. Well, I think there is this, it's a several step I can answer what you're asking in two steps. One is, how do we appoint, what do we look for in editorial board members? We usually like to have people who have been used on a number of occasions as referees, and in the opinion of other editorial board members or the associate editor, have given very fair, honest, balanced, knowledgeable reviews without, any bias and so forth. We also would like them to be leaders in their field, but even if relatively young, not the leader necessarily, but very good in their field, because we feel that it's important for the people whose papers are being reviewed to look at the editorial board and see if they're good. you know, were very well qualified names. Also, we're colored by who are the what field, who's leaving, where we have the greatest demand for new editors, and what fields we want to attract too. For example, there's a period where you might say there was a period where we might worry that we didn't get much of the newer molecular biology, or so correctly or incorrectly, you may appoint a few more editors who are knowledgeable in that area to show the community we want those papers, you see. Well, that's the editorial board. Now, the associate editors is really the next step. When we have a vacancy, or if we expand and need another associate editor, we obviously try to choose, use the same criteria, really, except we usually do that from people who are on the editorial board who've had a history that we know, because the associate editor requires an even different combination of techniques and competence. He has to be able to deal with the, he deals with the authors directly. He has to evaluate, there he doesn't have to know the individual fields as well, but be able to evaluate the competence of the reviews and when you need a new review and so forth. Because he really is the one that interacts with both the members of the board and the authors. And in very recent time, they've had another very important function, and that is with the journal getting this big, we're now getting to the associate editors get together two or three times a year, and decide on really a lot of policy questions, subject of course to the publications committee, but the associate editors know so much about the needs of what's going on that we try to reach a consensus. Mm-hmm. I mean, among other things, for example, that we have a certain amount of uniformity in the kind of papers that we consider contributions or not, because otherwise you might get two different associate editors. I mean, this is one of the big problems of size, acting a little bit differently. So, and then of course we discuss all of this amongst ourselves and then send it to the publications committee. And in the early days, and perhaps still occasionally, depending on the situation at any one time, the publications committee can take a very active or a permissive role in the appointments. And in the early days, the publications committee, when it was smaller, when the journal was small, really went over each name individually and made new suggestions. As the journals become bigger and bigger, they go over everything carefully, but it's a little harder to, when you have, say, well, if we have, say, 50 appointments for a given year, and you have to, since we don't, everybody doesn't accept, it means go only 75 or 80 names. So obviously, they have to depend more on what we tell them about the qualifications of the people. But in the associate editorship, of course, they have a very important role.
You were selected as associate editor in 68.
Yeah, and that was by Bill Stein, who was editor at the time.
Do you know why he selected you?
No, I don't. I hope he did for the reasons I just mentioned. I hope he did. I wouldn't be surprised though, that a small factor, but I have no reason to say that. is that it might have been that they thought it would be nice to have at least somebody in Bethesda. I mean, it isn't essential, but that might have been one of the criteria. However, there are a lot of people in Bethesda, so that would be not. I might mention also, from a history point of view, that when John Edsel was editor, he operated, of course, out of Cambridge, and before that, they had an operation at New Haven, and I'm not sure whether they continued some of that under John or not, but then it became apparent that they didn't, that, and this was true for the society in general, that they couldn't operate out of people's offices, and this is certainly true with the size now, as I mentioned, and they couldn't move every time there would be an administrative change. So now, for many years, since 1962, I think it is, or maybe somewhere around that time, 1962, 1964, the society offices have moved here, and are permanently here, regardless of who's president. And of course, the journal has its offices here too. And there again, it's pretty obvious it'd be impractical to move your, mm-hmm. an operation this size whenever there was a new editor. Just excuse me a minute. I just want to see where my wife's pen is on. This nondescript conversation down.
Well, someone else will transcribe it and produce a raw transcript, yeah. And then I will sit and listen to every tape and edit it.
I see.
Which I do on the computer. I don't do any hard copy editing. I just edit it right on the screen.
You mean they give it to you on the screen?
They give it to me with a raw transcript.
I see. Yeah.
Basically, and then I'll go through and edit it. So in some cases, I'll pull things out. None of us speak the way we write, and so if we see things we said verbally in print, sometimes it's
that's why I was asking you. It'd be
so I'll make
impossible,
it
possible. Yeah,
I'll make us both sound pretty good.
Yeah. So. What kind of computer do you use for this?
Well, I prefer a Macintosh, but we use a PC clone.
Yeah. Well, the same thing's true here. I use a Mac. This is always, it looks like this distinction between the scientific community and the office community. All of us use Macintosh at the lab, and I use a Macintosh. But at the office, they have PC clones. So I have to send it by the modem anyway, mm-hmm. because that's the only way they can get compatible. You see, otherwise I can put a disk in the morning when they pick up my bag. But by sending it over the phone, then they can pick it up on their computer and it works. But the Macintosh has so many advantages.
Oh, well, I now have a Mac PowerBook.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah. And I have my own Macintosh, and then I have the Office PC.
Yeah.
And I'll do things depending. I may do it on either one in the office. But with the PowerBook, I have it configured so that one quarter of it is DOS.
Oh, I see. You can do that now.
Something called Soft PC. There are other products
out there. I've seen that listed, yeah.
And I can literally go into that, and I have Microsoft, what do we use now? WordPerfect. Yeah. Not for Windows, but just WordPerfect.
I see. Yeah.
In DOS on there. So I can type something, and when I get back to the office, it's ready to go. I don't have to convert it, or if I want
Isn't
something.
That nice, yeah, yeah. Well, as I say, I send mine over as text only. Of course, I have to. Then I can't use Greek letters or bold, but usually I don't have to. But actually, I've been using an SE, and at the lab I use something funny. But I just got the one we just got because of the CD-ROM, and. It's so nice, I'm almost ashamed of it. But it's one of these new Centrics. But I need it for the CD-ROM because I think it's very important that I follow the CD, follow the technology of it to make sure that they're doing the conversions okay.